John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network, and I welcome the author and expert on intelligence gathering and operations, David Grantham. His new book is Consequences, An Intelligence Officer's War. This is a memoir of the time in Kabul, in Baghdad, in Kuwait City, when the United States was at risk from what we now understand to be a worldwide jihadist enterprise. However, in 2006, when David went to theater, both Afghanistan and Iraq, it was not at all clear what the larger story was. We have an understanding today that the story not only includes the jihadists of the Middle East and Central Asia, but the gangs called cartels in America, in South America, in Europe, all of these networks working together. And David's experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, the memoir, prepares me to understand what I'm witnessing in the third decade of the 21st century. The outlaws have become extremely clever and very well engaged with each other. David, congratulations and good evening. I begin in your deployment to a five-star hotel in Kuwait City. I mention that because it's a surprise to you as well. You arrive one night in Kuwait. You look around at the landscape. This is after the fighting in Iraq, but the Afghanistan war is going on in 2006. You are with the Air Force. What is your status with the Air Force, and what is your first experience looking at the, I believe it's the Crown Plaza five-star hotel in Kuwait City? Good evening to you, David.
John, thank you for having me. Yeah, I was a young officer who had just been sent to the Middle East on my first deployment with the Office of Special Investigations, which is really the FBI / CIA for the Air Force. And my first assignment was to Kuwait and to a five-star hotel of all places. So my first taste of deployment was unlike most people who deploy to the Middle East with the military. And it was an interesting environment, to say the least. It's not what I was expecting. It's not what you pack for. But there was a interesting development with Air Force assets, which the logistic lines that were going into Iraq at that time, many of them originated in Kuwait. Many officers and enlisted Army, Air Force would start in Kuwait and then go into theater, go into Iraq. A lot of those assets had to be protected. And as a counterintelligence agent with the Air Force, that was our job. It was protect, collect intelligence to protect those assets and the people. Well, the lodging is a very delicate situation in Kuwait. It's not easy to find. And therefore, many ended up being put up in these hotels. Standards require certain living conditions, and Kuwait really could only offer these magnificent hotels. And OSI agents like myself, we simply followed them to protect them with intelligence services. And so my first deployment was in the Crown Plaza in Kuwait, a magnificent hotel with magnificent restaurants and magnificent living conditions.
You were there enough time to understand that there was a war going on north of you in Iraq, a war against counterinsurgency, a counterinsurgency war, because at the time we did not know, but we do now, that Al-Qaeda was operating in Iraq and transforming itself into what would eventually become ISIS. You were in Kuwait City, however, and my surprise in your telling the book Consequences says all decisions have consequences is that your first deployment is not to Iraq, but it's to Afghanistan. And a fellow officer was a casualty of an IED, I believe, and you were immediately asked to go to Afghanistan. What was your mission there, David? How did it differ from what you understand your mission was in Kuwait City and Iraq?
Going to Afghanistan was you're going into theater versus being in a support role outside of the theater of war. And in Kuwait, the intelligence collection tends to be more political. It tends to be more broad. You're intending to understand what other adversaries are looking to collect on you, what information they're looking to use. When you get into theater, it becomes a bit more tactical and much more tangible in that you're collecting information to protect assets on the ground. So you would be gathering information in order to protect servicemen and women that were leaving the base to go execute operations. You would collect information on high-level terrorists, right, and insurgents, and supply that information. So that was when we get to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is really, you're getting to brass tacks, if you will. You're on the ground collecting information from sources, and we would leave the base all the time to do this and then supply that information to either protect the base or supply it to the action arm, if you will, of military forces, which could be special forces, Navy SEALs, all the way to the Rangers and whatnot, in order to go find these people and capture or kill them.
You arrive at Bagram Air Base. Let's plunge you into this. You've been at a five-star hotel, and Bagram Air Base, they give you a mattress that somebody's been sick with. They put you in a part of the deployment that you have no reason to believe you have security whatsoever. They're almost indifferent to your fate. So I would say, David, you have now experienced the 21st century plunging into the about 16th century. And at Bagram Air Base, the way you describe it, David, it felt like a smaller version of Da Nang Air Base during the Vietnam War, an American city with franchises everywhere and lots of traffic and no particular order of things. You have to make way for yourself. Is that what your early weeks there? Did it feel as if you'd been dropped into a puzzle and you had to solve it?
Yes, and the unique thing with Office of Special Investigations with Air Force OSI is we don't deploy in groups. We leave one by one. So traditional military, you will deploy with a unit or with a section. We deploy one by one. So what that means is you're on a plane by yourself with a bunch of other people you may not know. You're put in places that you've never been, and you're expected to adapt, whether there's one other agent there or whether there's an office of 15 agents. And that's what the Afghanistan situation was. I was asked to go backfill due to the death of one of our agents, and I was flown there from Kuwait. And it went from the five-star hotel to mountain ranges, snow-capped mountain ranges, a land that's been in war for decades, and living conditions that were obviously nowhere near the hotel. As you mentioned, the mattress I had the pleasure of resting on someone had vomited on that mattress not too long ago, but the supplies were short, so they flipped the mattress. But I was thrilled because I wanted to be there. I wanted to use what training I had in the war zone. So regardless of the circumstances, I enjoyed it immensely and was excited to be there.
You don't wear a uniform in Iraq. Do you wear a uniform when you're at Bagram Air Base, or are you always in civilian clothes, David?
OSI, we're always in civilian clothes unless we're deployed to a specific operation where uniforms are required. That could be a headquarters position or something of that nature. In Afghanistan, we were in civilian clothes. We have beards, and it's not, and some people confuse this, it's not an attempt to blend into the civilian population or anything like that. It's just more intended to keep a light cover, to keep a very shallow cover, because there are a lot of contractors that come to the base. There are a lot of civilians that are working on the base and all number of support capacity. So you're attempting just to make yourself less interesting looking, if you will. So we don't, and also there's a functional reason where OSI, we don't want to have rank. We don't want to intimidate anyone or make them feel they have power over us just based on what they observe with rank. So it's intended to blend in, but there's also a functional nature behind not having any rank displayed.
This is 2006. Here we are 15 years later. You read the news, David. You're a senior fellow at the Secure Free Society. You're extremely well informed about the threat to the United States around the world. Does it surprise you to hear that the Trump administration and now the Biden administration apparently are looking to leave Iraq with to pull our military out of Iraq and to turn it over to the Kabul government and whatever remains of the Taliban. Does that surprise you these many years later, given that you risked everything whenever you left Bagram Air Base?
It's a little surprising. I wouldn't say it's too surprising. I think the time and effort that's been spent there, whether it's been spent wisely or unwisely over the last two decades, I do think the return on investment is proving less and less. And it's hard to continually justify staying with the new threats that are emerging, the network style threats versus country based threats. So it's not surprising. And it is disappointing, but not necessarily disappointing in the pulling out so much as the execution leading up to that. I think we've come to a point where decisions have to be made as to whether it still is a functional operation. So it's either get out or reinvest. And I don't think there's the political will or capital to reinvest.
David Grantham, the new book is Consequences, an Intelligence Officer's War. Bagram is not enough for David. We're headed to Iraq. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a pleasure to speak to David Grantham, author. His new book is Consequences, an Intelligence Officer's War. This draws upon David's experiences in the Air Force when he was an armed federal officer in civilian clothes in Afghanistan at Bagram Air Base and outside. His predecessor lost his life because of an IED, but he's now back to assignment, and the assignment takes him into, well, at the edge of Kuwait and Iraq, a place called Boka, which is on the road about 6 hours' drive from Baghdad. He deploys there in conditions that are organized. There's a prison at Camp Boka, but at the same time, this is the height of the murder squad known as Zarqawi, the height of it. Zarqawi was recruiting, we know now, everywhere, in the prisons, in the camps, in the terps, the interpreters, on the roads. Everybody driving out there was a potential recruit for Zarqawi. David, you go to Camp Boka, and your job is there is to work with a fellow officer, and the two of you have an assignment that is not obvious to me at first, and apparently it wasn't obvious to the U.S. Army when you arrived. And you spend some time to make it clear to us that the U.S. Army is not in sympathy with Air Force federal armed officers. Is that something that was because of the tension of the time, David, or is this a general understanding that the services work suspiciously together?
Yes, and there is a brotherhood among the military, and there is also competition within the branches. And part of that is derived just from pride. The other part is actually functional separation. So when we arrive at Camp Boka, we are armed federal agents who are not in uniform. And frankly, we are there to support military or Air Force assets, security forces especially. And that was not advertised well to the Army. So much of a deployment is spent, we call it mission creep, where you end up places you probably weren't initially assigned to people who had no idea why you're there. And that was kind of the situation. There was a desperate need for counterintelligence support to protect our assets, much like we were doing in Kuwait, but also to understand how the prison was affecting radicalization and other things. So we were there to protect assets and to begin gathering information. We were the first OSI agents there. So you can only imagine the Army, who ran much of the administrative part of the base, were a bit dumbfounded to find two plainclothes officers from an obscure unit that most had never heard of there to collect intelligence on a threat that they weren't quite aware of. So there was a lot of explaining we had to do on the front end when we got there.
And your commanding officer was an Air Force Academy graduate. Introduce her, please.
Yes, Aaron and I had actually been together in Kuwait. And as I returned from Afghanistan, we got together and learned fairly quickly that her and I would both be deploying to Camp Buka together. And she was a very sharp academy grad, very dependable, and just a, so it was a, I had all the trust in her as the commanding officer, and I was thrilled to go there with her because I thought the two of us would be able to handle the situation well, seeing that we didn't have lodging, we didn't have an office, we had a book bag or a box of supplies to carry with us, and that was about it. But both of us had the mentality of getting the job done regardless of the circumstances. And so I was proud to have served with her in that capacity.
There's a lot of humor here, David. We're allowed to mention the fact that you eventually had to share a single wide trailer that you identify should have been condemned with the Army, and you had to find a way to keep it secure, and it was impossible, of course. I mean, there's always humor on Army bases that are slapped together, but I got the sense at Boca, the same way I did at Bagram, that you were not all that well taken care of, that there wasn't luxury, there wasn't first-rate equipment, there weren't officers in charge of making sure the infrastructure of the base ran. Did I misread that, or were these things hodgepodge, slapped together with no sense of permanence?
Yes, and that's the nature of deployments in general. The support, the physical infrastructure is often there, and it's tiered by what your rank is. And so we had many young enlisted who worked in the prison. They would sleep in a massive communal tent, and the air condition would go out on that tent more often than they would like. And of course, it's I believe April by now, so the temperatures are sometimes reaching in the hundreds during the day. But this was typical of the military, and we jokingly say you embrace the suck. You take what's given to you, and you just make the best of it as you can. So yes, the systems that were in existence weren't necessarily helpful either to living or to work, but that's kind of expected with a deployed environment. And obviously, we would wish for it to be better, and I imagine now if you talk to someone who deploys, the system has been in place for several years now and probably been upgraded significantly since I was there. But the function of our job required certain things that just couldn't be made available at a moment's notice. For example, a secret internet, we call it the SIPR. That had to be tied in a very specific way so we could share specific intelligence over this system. Those things come along once they know you're there, and they didn't know we were there until we were actually on the ground.
The book is Consequences, an Intelligence Officer's War. David Grantham is the author. David has now arrived in Iraq at the height of the power of Zarqawi and al-Qaeda. The murder squads are roaming the country at will. IEDs are routine supplied by the Iranian military. We know this now, the Al-Quds force of the IRGC. It's about as dangerous as the 21st century offers right now. When we come back, David and Aaron in the field. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. John Batchelor, this is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. David Grantham's book is Consequences, an Intelligence Officer's War. He not only survived Bagram Air Base, where IEDs had killed his predecessor, but he survived Iraq Zarqawi. David, did you know Zarqawi's reputation when you arrived? Did you believe it? Did everybody understand he was Murder Times 10 Incorporated and he was working intimately with the Iraqi people? Did you know that?
When we got there, we knew that. When I first arrived in theater in January 2006, I knew of him. And the turning point, and I mentioned this in the book, was the bombing of the Golden Dome Mosque in Iraq. It was a, it's a Shia holy site, very renowned in the Shia side of Islam. And when they bombed that mosque, when I say they, what it later was known to be Zarqawi, who was a Sunni al-Qaeda, that was a turning point. And I saw that. That was in February. About 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later, I am in Iraq at Camp Buka. We're now very well aware of who he is and his bloodthirsty approach to war. So we knew at that point that this was going to be a very, very significant fight against him, not only because he was attacking American forces, but because he was really fueling a burgeoning civil war between the Sunni and Shia in Iraq.
Right. You have a prison at Camp Buka, and you make a decision about how you're going to house the most radical of the detainees. We know now, many years later, that one of those detainees, not at your prison, at another prison in Iraq, turned out to be the man whom we know is credited to be the founder of ISIS. Did you understand the threat of the radicals recruiting inside that prison at the time?
We did. The information that came out of the prison and the intelligence we gained on those who had left and were in the field now, we knew then that the radicalization in the prison was ongoing and very significant. And the best thing the military could do at that time was simply divide in hopes that the radicalized would only congregate with the already radicalized. And therefore, they were merely reinforcing each other. The greatest fear was if a radicalized leader was let loose in other parts of the jail where there was people who were less adherent or just day-to-day criminals, they could become radicalized. And so we knew what was going on. We didn't know the significance of it and how it would turn out to be really the birthplace of the Islamic State.
Right. And we're still living with those consequences. As David's book is filled with irony, another detail here is the sources you develop in Iraq, and their names, and they're not all the right names, but they were sometimes interpreters, sometimes friend of interpreters. At the time, did you understand that they were all penetrated? How did you approach them, David? Did you count on their information, or did you believe that they were looking for weaknesses in your defenses? That's why they were being friendly to you.
Yeah, those are situations in which when you handle sources, when you handle informants, those things are always in the front of your mind. And there's a vetting process that you, when given more time than we had, you would go through a fairly lengthy and significant vetting process to ensure that the information they provide is credible. We had little time, and therefore we had to rely more on training and judgment and our linguists. And so when we pulled these guys in and talked to them, we would caveat and context their information in such a way that allowed us to analyze it for credibility as quick as we could, as reliably as we could.
You're on the road from Basra to Qusair on to Baghdad. Do I have the geography correct? If you're driving from Basra, you'd go through Camp Buka or by Camp Buka?
If you're traveling south from Basra, you would pass by Camp Buka on the way to the border with Iraq and Kuwait.
Right, and that would be the road north to Baghdad, that main highway from Basra
to
Baghdad.
Correct.
It's about 6 hours' drive. At no point, I knew you didn't get killed, David, because you wrote the book, but that's about the only thing I had confidence of. It felt like the whole base was under assault all the time. Did it feel like that when you were there, that they were looking for a major operation? For example, when that dump truck went missing.
The feeling at Camp Buka was you were sitting on a powder keg, because nobody wanted to address the issue of being in southern Iraq. When I say nobody, high-ranking military, no one wanted to start a war with really the country that had the most presence in southern Iraq, which is Iran. That was where you felt like you were on the edge of a major war if you made the wrong decision. Being at Camp Buka, it wasn't similar to maybe places up north where they were receiving mortar fire on a daily basis. What was more significant at Camp Buka was the feeling of trying to collect information against the threats from Iran outside the base, collect information on Al-Qaeda, who was in your prison, while also not stepping on a, you know, theoretical political landmine that may spark a fight in southern Iraq that would directly involve Iranian forces. That was the delicate balance you had to take. And as I say in the book, intelligence is naturally, intelligence collection, the practice of it is naturally, it's provocation. You are poking into places and talking to people and asking questions that they don't want you to ask. And that didn't suit the situation in southern Iraq at the time, but we had a job to do. So we really tried to thread the needle of collecting the information without sparking a larger geopolitical conflict.
You have an Iraqi named whom you call in the book Mo. Mo at some point starts to Q&A with you, and you learn from him that a man named Al-Sadr has told Mo and all of the rest of them not to work with the Americans or at least be hostile towards the Americans. That's Muki Al-Sadr, the semi-official, semi-religious cleric who commands a major neighborhood in Baghdad. In my memory, because, you know, David, I've been at this as long as you have. I just never went to war. I just talked about it. Who would routinely rocket and mortar the American embassy and the American forces in Baghdad. When you learned Al-Sadr's name from Mo, did you understand that was threatening?
Absolutely. When he says Al-Sadr, it tells us two things. Al-Sadr is the face of Shia militantism in Iraq. And the fact that his message was trickling down to southern Iraq, which is the Shia stronghold for the nation, that obviously was construed as a significant threat to the point that he felt comfortable enough telling people that they shouldn't work with Americans. And he's up in Baghdad, but yet he had the power to send that message down almost to the border with Kuwait. That told us that he had significant sway and had proxies on the ground and the support of Iran in order to pull that off, issue those threats and people follow through and obey or comply at minimum.
I'm going to ask the same matter I asked about Afghanistan. These many years later, you're a veteran of the Iraq War. You were as vulnerable as it gets, David. You know that now. You look back upon it. The U.S. left Baghdad militarily, officially, some years ago during the first Obama administration. There are elements, special forces, there are supply units, all of that still entangled in some fashion. But these many years later, what is your measure of the sacrifice you and your colleagues made for the Iraqi people? Do you believe it was futile? Do you believe it was misdirected, given what's happened, that Iraq is now completely, well, let's put it this way, understood to be under the thumb of Tehran, our enemy?
Unfortunately, I think the execution in Iraq was flawed from the beginning, although at the time, we've experienced something in our country with September 11th that was really unparalleled for many generations, especially for my generation. And so the anxious spirit to address it, I think, was needed, or it was natural and understood. But unfortunately, I think the execution in Iraq and the planning was underestimated what the situation was going to be. Now, one thing Iraq did do is attract people like Zarqawi. It attracted the Al-Qaeda types to a location where we could fight. Unfortunately, you hate to just throw away the Iraqi people as if Iraq is just a middle ground that you can fight your enemies on. These are people. These are towns. These are families. So the execution on the front end and the planning was poor in comparison, perhaps, to other engagements we've been in. But to play devil's advocate, for the administration and for those in government at the time, we were fighting a threat. When you've talked about with networks, with terrorist organizations that have no homeland, they have no central authority. There was a big learning process, and I think that's where we contributed the most, is being able to come out of Iraq and understand the threat that much better. Understand Iran, a state. Understand their influence in these terrorist networks. Prior to 9/11, we had a rudimentary grasp on that. Coming out of Iraq, despite the poor planning and other things, we came out very educated, very well suited to better address the threat and the nuances within that threat.
The book is Consequences, An Intelligence Officer's War. David Grantham is the author. David is a senior fellow at the Secure Free Society. And when we come back, I'm going to draw on David's experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, especially with networks of very dangerous, extremely organized people, and how it can begin to interpret what's going on in Central America and South America today with the U.S. as the target. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. David Grantham, a veteran of the United States Air Force, an armed federal authority once upon a time. He worked with the Air Force in Afghanistan at the worst of it in Bagram Air Base, and in Iraq at the very worst of it during the late months of Zarqawi, who was eventually killed by a U.S. Air Force airstrike north of Baghdad in the middle of 2006. But here we are 15 years after Zarqawi's death. He was Murder Incorporated, and Murder Incorporated has changed its address. We now call it the cartels that are running the human trafficking, the drug running, the contraband running, the weapons running, and possibly also the penetration of our southern border by our enemies. The cartels run it. David works on these matters for the Secure Free Society, and his website has an elaborate and extremely helpful diagram of how networks work together. So my first question is an innocent one, David. The Zarqawi network and the integration of al-Qaeda into the Sunni and Shia conflict that was 2006-2007, does that help? Does that interpret what we're seeing with the cartels today, how they work together, how they recruit on the American side, how gangs in America are working with the cartels as far north as Chicago? Is that a revelation, or do we know what that is and we should apply the methods we learned in Iraq, David?
We learned quite a bit in Iraq that is helpful for today to understanding the concept of networks. I would argue that the network situation in Iraq at the time I was there, what I recount in my book, was a smaller version of what we are encountering today, in that it's more ideologically driven, so there is an affinity for shared ideas, and within that, there may be different skill sets, but they're all driving towards a similar goal. What we see today, especially in Latin America with Mexican cartels and their connection to states who sponsor them, like Venezuela, like Iran through proxies and Hezbollah, they've achieved a larger network concept and operation that includes people who have no interest in, let's say, the drug trade or the human trafficking trade, but they know the business is very lucrative, and therefore they will use their skill set, whatever that may be. It may be a lender who has connections to the banking system who can move money covertly. They're not a cartel member. They're not used as a person directly supporting some sort of illicit activity, but they do have a skill set that can assist them in order to achieve some of that. The networks today incorporate all these different people with different abilities, different assets, access to different things. That's what makes them much more complicated, is the more people that join that network, the more lucrative the network becomes, the harder it is to dismantle it.
The Bolivarian threat network you analyze. Is the Bolivarian threat network driven, financed, integrated with the Al-Quds force, with the IRGC? Is it also integrated and networked with Cuban secret police? And by extension, that would include some connection to Moscow. Is all that working together, David?
The short answer is yes. The Bolivarian threat network originated out of Venezuela, and Venezuela under the leadership of Hugo Chavez and now under the leadership of Nicolas Maduro. And they have built a network that reaches into those places that are have a political affinity, such as Cuba, who has long been a partner of the Venezuelan regime. But it also touches countries like Iran and those other groups, as you mentioned, that support them through any number of means. We know, for instance, Hezbollah and the IRGC are have worked in money laundering for cocaine distribution. We also know that they have been training Venezuelan operatives in order to carry out attacks against the United States. So there's a symbiotic relationship. There's a political affinity. And then there's the financial commitments that are tied into these Bolivarian threat networks. And you mentioned Russia. China is another one. They come in with loans offered to finance these different countries. And in turn, they receive influence, power, and monetary benefit to those loans. So these networks are, each one may have a different reason for participating in this network, but they're all there. And it's a very dangerous organized grouping of different states and organizations at a place that's not far from our southern border.
You're living in North Texas, and the governor of Texas and the Department of Public Safety in Texas and Texas law authorities along the border have been very clear that the migrants pushing into the United States are overwhelming the authorities. We know this for housing. At the same time, a Wall Street Journal reporter tells me recently that the Department of Public Safety in Texas believes that the cartels are using the migrants, these waves of unaccompanied children, these extremely tragic family situations, to overwhelm the authorities because on one part of the border they're running rafts of children across and they have to be intercepted. On another part of the border, they use that very moment to get across guns and money and drugs. Is that true, David, to your understanding?
Absolutely. And this is not new. The key here is not so much how they're doing it, but the strategy. And the strategy has always been distraction. In Latin America, there is, unfortunately, there's levels of corruption between governments and borders that's something that we don't in the United States encounter on a daily basis. So where corruption thrives, it is easier to move people, weapons, and money under the protection or under the view of government officials. And in the United States, once they reach our border, the ability to corrupt becomes a bit more difficult. So therefore, distraction and overwhelming the system becomes the priority approach to moving drugs and weapons, etc. So drugs have been moved this way over the border for decades, where, for instance, you may encounter a vehicle with drugs and you make a bust, or I say you, the border patrol or whoever, whatever U.S. agents are down there. Meanwhile, the cartel is moving drugs at another part of the border. More drugs, higher end drugs. So they allow for some drugs to get caught. That's a standard practice that's been around for a while. And today they're merely using children. And it shows you both depravity of the cartels, that they would sacrifice children, the survival of these children for the mere purpose of overwhelming the U.S. system and to get their own drugs and weapons across the border. It's one thing when they sacrifice drugs to move more drugs. Now we're talking about sacrificing children in order to move the drugs. There's a depravity there that we have yet to really get our mind wrapped around, I think, in the United States.
David Grantham, the book, his new book, Consequences, an Intelligence Officer's War. This is David's memoir of his time when he was at extreme risk at Bagram Air Base with the Air Force, at Camp Buka with the Air Force, in Iraq with the Air Force. And today he is a senior fellow at Secure Free Society, using his skill set taught by the Air Force and by security in the U.S. to analyze what is going on in the southern border, which is Zarqawi times 5,000. Good heavens. All the bad guys, all in one place. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.